listening to the Dave Congleton Show on KBEC News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM. Matt Hoyce sitting in for Dave, who's recovering from heart surgery. Dan Shadwell will be back with you steering the ship tomorrow. Right now, we've got Casey Johnson, professor of history, Brooklyn College, and the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is the author, with Stuart Taylor Jr., of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at American Universities. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the reason why I contacted you is because we had this story in the Slow Tribune yesterday, headlined, "Will Fewer College Students Report Sexual Assault After This California Court Ruling?" And you are the guy to talk to. And this kind of jumped out at me, and the first thing I wanted to do was talk to you because I remember you from when you were covering the Duke lacrosse rape story. So
That's correct.
So you've been doing this a long time. Let's kind of start at the beginning, and I think the beginning of this is the Dear Colleague letter. Can you tell our listeners what the Dear Colleague letter was and kind of what effect it had on rape reporting on college campuses?
Sure. In 2011, the Obama administration's Office for Civil Rights, which is the agency within the Department of Education that oversees implementation of Title IX, which is a gender discrimination law, says it can't be gender discrimination in higher ed, which was passed in 1972. 2011, the Obama Office for Civil Rights issues a letter addressed to colleagues, so it comes to be known as the Dear Colleague letter, that says that 40 years after the passage of Title IX, OCR has reinterpreted the law to require universities to use a variety of procedures when they adjudicate a student-on-student allegation of sexual assault. And every procedural change that the Dear Colleague letter included made it more likely that an accused student would be found guilty. They called for lowering the standard of proof. They called for allowing accusers to appeal a not guilty finding for the accused. They strongly discouraged cross-examination, and in subsequent guidance, they basically eliminated cross-examination. And they required training of all adjudicators, which in theory makes sense, but in practice wound up basically the equivalent of a criminal trial if the prosecutor got to train the jury with reading material that the defense lawyer didn't see. It was an inherently unfair process. And the message that was sent to colleges that if they didn't follow this guidance, they could risk losing federal funds, and no college could survive that because mm-hmm. it's not just federal research funds that would be coming. It would be federal financial aid, and so the student enrollment would plunge. And so very quickly, colleges that were not in line got in line and implemented these procedures. And the result was a skyrocketing instance of allegations of sexual misconduct and a skyrocketing number of students found guilty of sexual misconduct under these new procedures that were heavily tilted towards the student who filed the complaint.
Well, now, why was this? I understand the Dear Colleague letter kind of required this, but were the rape numbers and sexual assault numbers going up, you know, from a criminal standpoint? Was this a true two-track thing where there was this process going on at the college and another process going on at the legal system at the same time?
Quite the reverse. If you look at, basically any violent crime statistic in the United States since the 1990s, violent crime rates throughout the country have gone down, whether it's murder or felony assault or sexual assault. But the Obama administration used surveys that had been by a group of academics in 2007 that claimed that one in five college women, female undergraduates, were victims of sexual assault while they were at school. This is a fantastic number. There were around 10 million female undergraduates in the U.S. It would suggest that every 5 years, 2 million of them are victims of sexual assault. It would suggest that the typical college campus is by far the most dangerous neighborhood in virtually any city that had a college. And you would think if the administration really believed those numbers, and I doubt that they really did, the first priority would have been flooding the typical campus with increased law enforcement to deal with this incredible threat of violent crime. And then when you look a little bit behind these statistics, what you see is it tends to be very, very broad definitions of sexual assault, unwanted touching, which may well be inappropriate, but is not what you normally think of when you're thinking of a crime of sexual assault. And lots of these allegations involved instances where both parties had been drinking, where consent was ambiguous. Again, not what one would think of the issue of sexual assault. But the argument was that there was an epidemic, that the epidemic had to be met, and the only way to meet it was to diminish the procedural protections of the accused, under the belief that if a student knew that the person that she was likely to accuse, that she accused, would likely be found guilty, it would make it more likely that a student would file a complaint. It's a very strange sort of procedural approach that the administration took.
So, looking at this article, some things kind of jumped down at me, and frankly, I think they've changed the headline on it. I don't think that was the headline that originally appeared on it. But one of the subheads down there says, converting classrooms into courtrooms, and like I said, I've been following this issue, and it seems like it's more like turning. They turn classrooms into star chambers, and now the star chambers are being turned into courtrooms. Is that maybe more accurate about what's happening?
It's wholly accurate. I mean, that statement came from the deputy general counsel in the Cal State system, and it was you don't want to use the word or the phrase willfully deceptive lightly, but it was a willfully deceptive statement. Since 2011. Colleges have been adjudicating these quasi-criminal charges, a sexual assault allegation. They're not adjudicating in the classroom. This doesn't occur, in front of a professor with a bunch of students around. The way these allegations had worked between 2011 and 2018, when we saw the first of what have been now five appellate decisions in the California courts, would be that an investigator would be hired. So someone without any real academic credentials at all, an investigator would be hired by the Title IX office. He or she would speak to the student filing the complaint. They would speak to the student who was accused. There would be no hearing frequently, no cross-examination, no opportunity to see exculpatory evidence. But this isn't what occurs in any classroom in the country, I doubt. It occurs in any classroom in the Cal State system. It was in effect a star chamber. It was a rigged system that was designed to presume the student guilty and then deny him the tools that were necessary to prove his innocence. So it's simply a deceptive claim to suggest that the courts are now suddenly ordering colleges to engage in non-academic conduct. The colleges were doing that already.
So I know you've been following this. What stands out to you, to give our listeners an idea of kind of the excesses of the system that has caused, as you noted, five appellate courts to kind of come down on the process that these colleges have been using? What are some of the horror stories, the most egregious examples of where students have been railroaded or affected by this?
So I think there's a general pattern in these procedures to deny any sort of hearing. So you have a situation where a student can be accused, not even know the specifics of the allegation against him, have no opportunity to present any kind of cross-examination of the only person who was accusing him. And in some instances, if there is a hearing, the accuser doesn't even appear. So there was a case, for instance, at Amherst College in Massachusetts, where the accuser sent text messages on the night of the incident, saying that she regretted seducing the guy because the guy was her roommate's boyfriend, and saying that she needed to come up with a lie to explain what she had done. And the college subsequently claimed that those text messages were irrelevant because they were only interested in evidence that occurred after the accuser made the allegation of sexual assault. So by that allegation, there'd be no exculpatory evidence at all. You could just sort of wish it away. It's a case at Swarthmore College where the allegation was filed by the accuser's fiancé, who found out that his fiancé had slept with a student behind his back, and he claimed that he had a confession by the male accused student. And it turns out when the email was revealed, he had threatened to kill the guy. It was an email saying that he carried a gun, and that if the guy didn't confess to his sins, that he'd come after him. And Swarthmore, you know, found the guy guilty, and there was a suit, and eventually Swarthmore settled. There was this awful case at Occidental College in outside of L.A., where two freshmen meet very early in the term. Both had been drinking. The accuser texts the male student asking him if he has a condom. She texts a friend saying that she's about to go and have sex, and then she subsequently files a sexual assault allegation when the male student, after they have sex, says that he's not interested in a relationship. And the argument that the college makes in finding the guy guilty is that the accuser, despite sending these multiple texts, was incapacitated by alcohol and could not have formed consent. It was just this sort of bizarre line of argument. So lots of these cases are cases where both parties are using alcohol, where there's some evidence of consent, but the college dismisses it. Or there are cases where the accused student never really has a chance to test the allegations at all by asking questions of the accuser or by receiving exculpatory evidence that the college might have found in its investigation.
We're talking with K.C. Johnson, professor of history at Brooklyn College and author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities. We're going to take your calls. News Talk 920 KVEC 96.5 FM. Give us a call if you've got a question. 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. We'll be right back.
Standing in the Alpha Beta parking lot, watching the sunset. I'll never forget. Watching all the reds and oranges slip away, letting go of yet another dirty day.
You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show, News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM. Matt Hoy in for Dave Congleton. Our producer, Craig, playing my favorite theme song now.
It's your new favorite.
My new favorite, as my first job in high school was at the Alpha Beta, bagging groceries and collecting carts and all that other sort of fun stuff.
In the parking lot.
In the parking lot. We're on the air with K.C. Johnson, professor of history, Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is the author, with Stuart Chaylor Jr., of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities. K.C., I was looking at another article that kind of shocked me. It's about former USC kicker Matt Boermeester, who was expelled because he allegedly assaulted his girlfriend, except his girlfriend says, he never assaulted me, we were just playing around, and USC expelled him. They told his girlfriend that she was just a victim, you know, she had battered women syndrome, and it seems like, you know, how often is this happening? Do we have a number of how many of these, how much these charges started to increase after that Dear Colleague letter? I'm sure some of these are genuine reports of sexual assault. The question is, how many of them? Do we have any idea on that?
We don't. There's some data on the number of lawsuits. There have been around 420 lawsuits filed by accused students, including Matt Boermeester, who sued USC and who drew a difficult judge, lost in the lower court, and is now appealing to the appellate court in California. CU students have won more than they've lost in these lawsuits, which is really rare in the matter of campus disciplinary matters. The only other data that exists, because colleges, you know, sometimes make this stuff public, sometimes they don't, but what they do have to make public is the number of criminal allegations that occur on campus itself. They're required to report this federal law called the Clery Act. And there have been around 35,000 allegations since the Dear Colleague letter in 2011. Now, not all of those would involve student-on-student allegations. If it's someone who came on campus and sexually assaulted someone, a non-student, that would be reported under Clery. Not necessarily all of those cases would come forward, but I think what we can safely say is that there have been tens of thousands of cases filed under these really rigged procedures since the Dear Colleague letter came down in 2011. So California has been kind of ground zero for this because there are so many universities in the state, and because the state government has been really quite aggressive in sort of supplementing the Dear Colleague letter with other legislation designed to sort of tilt the process. But the lawsuits have occurred in virtually every state, at all different kinds of universities, public, private, research universities, elite liberal arts colleges, you know, mid-range schools. It's a kind of national epidemic of these lawsuits now.
And the idea, and I want to touch on this because, you know, we hear it all the time, the idea that women don't lie about this. That's not true, and we got plenty of evidence that's not true, right? Sometimes they do.
Right. I mean, indeed, sometimes they do. The case that I had mentioned earlier at Amherst, it was clearly a case of a false allegation. The woman actually admitted in a text that her goal was to lie. The case that got me involved in all of this, the Duke Lacrosse case, was a clear lie. A very high-profile case at the University of Virginia a couple of years ago. You know, this woman claimed that she was raped by a person who didn't exist. She had made him up, based him on a character in Dawson's Creek, designed to make a person jealous. The other thing, though, that I think that's really important in understanding these issues is that there are a certain number of cases where the student who is filing the allegation is not lying. She is telling what she believes to be the truth. But the accused student still must be not guilty. You know, even under these college procedures, it's supposed to be a preponderance of the evidence. So, if the person is not 51% certain that the offense happened, they're supposed to come back with a not guilty finding. The problem is that there's such an atmosphere now on college campuses to believe the survivor, you know, the idea that if you file an allegation, it has to be treated as true, that in these kind of ambiguous cases where there's lots of evidence to suggest that, you know, it didn't happen, but you can't absolutely say it was false, the temptation is nonetheless to come back with a guilty finding.
We're talking with K.C. Johnson, and you're here on the Dave Collinsworth Show, News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM.
KVC.
For Dave, Dan Shadwell will be back tomorrow. Right now, we've got K.C. Johnson, author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities. K.C., you know, I'm looking at the San Luis Obispo Tribune article, and you had pointed this out to me, that the comments from State Senator Barbara Jackson, or Hannah Beth Jackson out of Santa Barbara, were kind of piqued your interest. Let me read them, and then I will kind of seek out your opinion. She said, "Clearly we need to respect one's constitutional right to due process," said Jackson, who recently introduced state legislation on the issue. As an aside, you saw this coming. But, she added, There's a difference between a criminal proceeding where the accused's personal liberty and freedom is at stake and an administrative hearing. To conflate them is the height of misogyny and sexism. We do want to provide due process, Jackson said. There's a way to get there without discouraging victims to come forward. This kind of struck me as the old line from St. Augustine, you know, "Oh Lord, make me chaste, but not yet."
Right, right. She's saying that she wants due process, but she doesn't really want due process. You know, one striking thing from this statement was that she doesn't say what procedures she actually would be willing to, you know, to deal with in terms of how could a student defend himself. And the other thing, it's quite true that that these campus tribunals are not criminal justice arenas, although all of this material can be subpoenaed by a prosecutor and can be used in a trial. But the point remains that whether it's a criminal trial or whether it's an administrative proceeding, the purpose is still to determine whether or not the allegation is truthful. And the best way to do that is by allowing robust procedural protections to test the veracity of the allegation. And, you know, certainly in cases like this, where often there are no witnesses, the idea that providing some form of cross-examination, some opportunity for the accused student to test whether the allegations make any sense, is hardly an unreasonable argument. Senator Jackson seems to be saying, you know, we really don't want due process, but I'm a politician and I can't say that I don't want due process for these students, so I'll simply oppose anything that the court structure. And the really interesting thing about this statement is a few years ago, California passed this law called affirmative consent, and they said that in campus cases, but not in any other cases, the accused student had to obtain verbal or clear physical consent before any sexual act.
But and each yes step means, of the way,
yes,
too.
Rather than no means step. Each step of the way, precisely. And one of the legislative sponsors of this was asked, well, how could an accused student defend himself under these terms? And her answer was, the courts can decide this. In this case, the courts have decided it, and Senator Jackson's response is, I don't like what the courts say, and so now we're not going to listen to the courts. These are five appellate decisions within California. Most of the judges who made these decisions were appointed by Democratic governors, and so it's not as if this was some sort of conservative conspiracy. These are mainstream jurists who are basically saying you have to give a sense of fairness before you brand a student a sex criminal for the rest of his life.
And that's the other thing. You know, she says it's not a criminal proceeding where his liberty, in most cases his, liberty and freedom are at stake. It's an administrative hearing, but it's also getting him branded a sex offender. It's getting him expelled from a university. It's impacting his ability to get into any other university or graduate program. Why is that, you know, less than, okay, yeah, it's less than going to prison, but it's still pretty serious.
It forecloses additional educational opportunities. Down the road, any job that requires a background check, it's essentially going to ensure that the student is not going to get that job, because what business, you know, understandably, is going to hire someone who has been deemed guilty of sexual misconduct. So it's a decision that has a life-altering impact, in all likelihood is going to lead to hundreds of thousands, or potentially in some cases millions of dollars in earning potential that is lost as a result of the decision, will foreclose whole kinds of careers that might have been open for an accused student that would not be otherwise. And if the guy is guilty, you know, this is a deserved punishment. But you can't start with the presumption that the guy is guilty and, you know, that he's deserving of these punishments simply to address a broader societal problem, which seems to be the position that Senator Jackson has, seems to have been the position that the Obama administration had on this issue, and seems to be a lot of the position that we see from Title IX activists on the question.
We're talking with Casey Johnson about the college Title IX process for reporting sexual assault and rape, and what the courts have been doing in order to enforce some due process on that. If you've got a question for Casey about this, please give us a call, 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. You know, that story had a link to Senator Jackson's website, and it has PR press release here, and it has some bullet points. I want to run these by you. First off, she, in her little press release, repeats the claim that studies show at least 1 in 5 U.S. women and 1 in 8 men survive sexual assault as undergraduates. Again, that makes our university some of the most dangerous places in the United States. Men, do not send your daughters to university. Okay, you're better off sending them to East L.A. or Baltimore or someplace like that. They'll be a lot safer.
Right, but you know, if you look at the cities that have the highest rates of violent crime, according to the FBI, you know, Detroit, Baltimore, Memphis, you know, their rate of violent crime is much lower than 1 in 5. And so if the senator really believes this, she needs to be advocating for a far greater law enforcement presence on campus.
We got a caller for Casey?
Yeah, Rick. We got Phil, you're on.
Phil.
Yeah, Casey, I think you're absolutely spot on with your analysis of how Hannah Beth Jackson responded to this. I do have a daughter that's going to college, and it's going to require me as a parent to sit down and have that discussion with her to be understanding if something like this is to happen. She would bring it to me, and we would follow the same procedure, and I would support her 100%. I think it's negate to the individual to, you know, just to say, oh, I'm sorry, you're guilty, and there's going to be one side of the story. I want to make sure that everybody has that opportunity, and I'm looking out for my daughter. It was really a gulp at first when I read it, but it just is going to take as a parent to be engaged with my daughter and everything else. I also have 2 boys, and I would hate for them be accused of something they didn't do and then be expelled and never have an opportunity to finish an education.
Casey?
Yeah, if there's one thing that this process should result in is far greater parental involvement in sort of the experiences of students that go to colleges in a couple of respects. You know, the first is that there was a study by United Educators, which insures a lot of colleges and universities, and they found that around 2/3 of these cases, and in some years more than 90% of the cases, involved both parties using alcohol. And I think, you know, sort of frank discussions with college-age kids about the dangers of using alcohol, especially, you know, in parties where you don't know lots of people, are reasonable, because it's not as if all of these allegations are false. They're not. You know, it's an important claim to have, especially, you know, the data here is unimpeachable that students, as they enter college in their first couple of weeks on campus, are particularly vulnerable because often they're inexperienced with sex, they're inexperienced with heavy alcohol use, they're in a completely different environment than they existed before, and I think parents really do need to have these sort of frank exchanges. And one of the problems with the kind of statistics that Senator Jackson may have touted on her website is that it creates this sense of utter panic. You know, if 1 in 5 are actually being assaulted, you'd think there's almost nothing that you can do. Whereas, in fact, a more prudent conversation would be beneficial to all. So, yeah, I think that the idea of parental involvement and frank parental discussions with their children before they go off to college is a really, really good thing to do.
Thanks for the call.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, Casey, you know, I a couple years ago, I briefly, a little over a year, wrote a column for the local newspaper here, that San Luis Obispo Tribune, same one that published this article. And we had a case up here 20-some-odd years ago, a girl named Kristen Smart, who got, you know, freshman, got tipsy, and she's disappeared. She no one has seen her for 20-plus years. She is assumed to have been murdered. They think they know who did it, but they can't charge the kid because they haven't found her body. And I wrote a column, basically, you know, and it was the same time campuses were starting up at Cal Poly here. And I wrote a column basically saying, odds are what happened to Kristen Smart won't happen to you. But if you are drinking alcohol, stay with a group of girls. Stay with friends. Do not walk off with one, you know, some boy you don't know. Because, you know, 999,999 times, you'll survive. You'll be okay. You know, you might get assaulted. That's possible. But there's one in a million times where you become like Kristen Smart and we don't know what happened to you. And the local paper wouldn't publish that because I was blaming the victim. And it seems like you can't give, you know, reasonable advice. You know, it's like you should be able to do whatever you want to do and not worry about the consequences because, you know, if you have to worry about the consequences, then, you know, somebody else is infringing on your rights.
Yeah, it's a very strange argument, and this blame the victim is pervasive. And the comparison that I draw here is imagine that you live in a neighborhood that has a very large number of burglaries. And the police come around and say, you know, you really should lock your doors and you might want to put in a burglar alarm. That wouldn't be blaming the victim. It would simply be a prudent response to a high crime area. And so for those who really believe that 2 million female undergraduates are going to be sexually assaulted on college campuses in the next 5 years, you would think a primary thrust of their policy would be, all right, here are the things that we need to do to avoid this. And instead, what we've seen is, you know, this just overwhelming emphasis on punishment and creating these kind of rigged systems, which really does suggest that the agenda here is something quite different.
It's
inexplicable in a lot of ways.
We're talking with Casey Johnson, author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities. Give us a call, 805-543-8830, 1-800-549-5832. You're listening to The Dave Congleton Show on KVEC 920 AM, 96.5 FM. You're listening to The Dave Congleton Show on News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM, KVEC. We have on the line Casey Johnson, professor of history, Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's the author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities. You know, Casey, one of the things on this article is, that they put up really high is the idea that the accuser would have to face cross-examination from the accused. So if a woman was attacked, she'd have to sit there across the table from the man who allegedly attacked her and answer his questions. Down deeper in the article, it seems to suggest that that's not what the courts are suggesting, that there's plenty of ways around that. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, the courts have been crystal clear. There isn't a single court in the country that has required that colleges must allow the accused and accuser to sit in the same room and the accused to directly ask questions. Colleges always have the option, first of all, of not having the two parties in the same room at all. Colleges are allowed to have Skype or video conferencing. In some cases, colleges have set up barriers. That's a little bit more problem. But colleges have the technology not to have the two parties in the same room at the same time, and you know that's allowed. The second thing is that there is absolutely nothing. There hasn't been a single court decision anywhere in the country that says that colleges are precluded from saying, "All right, we don't want, for reasons that are understandable, the parties to ask questions of themselves, and so instead we'll allow them to have a lawyer represent them and have the lawyer ask questions." Colleges don't want that because that means that the lawyer might wrest control of the situation from the colleges. So, yeah, it's this strange argument that it's traumatic to have the accuser directly cross-examined, which it may very well be, but the colleges are unwilling to mitigate this because doing so would undermine the rigged process overall.
Yeah. Looking at Senator Hannabeth Jackson's proposed legislation, I want to hit you with the bullet points and get a reaction from you on each of these. First, it would change the California Education Code so that it would require schools to investigate reports of sexual harassment and assault, regardless of whether they took place on or off campus. What do you think about
this? This is a response to the proposed DeVos regulations, which were unclear on this. This is, you know, of the critiques made of DeVos, this I think is probably the one that has the most substance, in large part because there are lots of schools where students live very close to off my first job was at Arizona State, down in Tempe, Arizona, and most of the students lived in off-campus apartments that were right next to the school. And so in those kinds of arrangements, that seems to me fine. It's much more problematic. Let's say you have two students who meet in, you know, in France or something during the summer, and there's an allegation of sexual assault, where the college is essentially serving as a substitute for the criminal justice process, and that really is beyond the scope of a campus investigation.
Okay. It would also prohibit live cross-examination of either student, complainant or respondent.
Right, and this gets back to the point that we were talking about earlier, which is that Senator Jackson really doesn't favor due process at all.
Right.
The legislature does not have the authority to overrule the courts, which is what she seems to want to do.
She says she wants them to use a preponderance of the evidence standard in determining whether a respondent student is responsible, and if so, take immediate action.
Yeah, this is the DeVos Title IX regulations allow schools to make that choice, and there hasn't been a single school that has chosen not to do a preponderance of the evidence. So, in effect, this would be ordering schools to do what they're already doing.
Okay. It would provide training to school officials involved in investigations.
Yeah, and this is critical. I mean, the problem here in the appropriate analogy is to imagine in a trial that the prosecutor got to train the jurors with material that inclined the jurors to return a guilty verdict and was allowed not to show that training to the defense. And that's what happens in these campus training processes. The accused student never gets to see what the training material for adjudicators is. And so you'll get training that will say, for instance, that counterintuitive behavior by the accuser is actually an indication of guilt. And so you have a system where intuitive behavior is a sign of guilt and counterintuitive behavior is a sign of guilt. Anything becomes a sign of guilt.
That's very convenient. It says, yeah. Use trauma-informed and impartial investigation procedures, including opportunity for both parties to present witness and other evidence.
Yeah, that's almost a mutually contradictory statement. One of the problems in these campus tribunals is that trauma-informed procedures have been inherently partial. That essentially the argument is that virtually any conduct is associated with guilt. And so there's a difference between treating a complainant with respect and sensitivity and presuming that the complainant is a victim of trauma and therefore something happened to her. The latter is inappropriate. The former is what colleges should be doing.
And finally, she says, notify students of complaint procedures and timelines.
That's entirely appropriate. Colleges should be doing that. Frequently, they're not. They very rarely don't do that with accusers. What they often don't do with accused students, and it's interesting that she doesn't really go beyond here. One of the key aspects in these procedures is that colleges often don't provide specific notice to the accused students of what offenses he's actually accused of. They'll simply say, you're accused of violating our sexual misconduct policy, but he doesn't know what the specifics of the allegations are.
So what is going to happen here in the next couple of years? Again, we've had these five appellate court decisions. We've got Betsy DeVos over in the Department of Education, who's withdrawn that Dear Colleague letter and is trying to impose some due process things. We've got about 45 seconds left. What's going to happen with this over the next couple of years?
What we're heading towards is a titanic clash between the courts and the DeVos regulations on the one hand that are basically saying we want fair treatment for the accused, and colleges and blue state legislatures on the other, which are saying we want a rigged system. And eventually, this is an issue that's going to have to be resolved by high courts, by state Supreme Courts, and ultimately probably by the U.S. Supreme Court, about whether an accused student actually is entitled to a fair process before he's branded a sex criminal.
We've been talking with K.C. Johnson, author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities. You can find that online at Amazon and wherever excellent books are sold. This has been the Dave Congleton Show. Matt Hoy sitting in for Dave Congleton. KVEC News Talk, 920 AM, 96.5 FM.